Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1147. The space plane and COVID-19, the paperclip legacy, part two. This is being recorded on August 26th of the year 2020. As I indicated in part one, this program, although it once again will take us back to events during and immediately after World War II, is inextricably linked with the power political and economic dynamics that are driving the world today. As I said in part one, recorded yesterday, as we are speaking, the Republican Convention is underway. And as this series continues, we will be talking about how the Republican Party not only grew out of some of the economic and power political, the contemporary of Republican Party, how it grew out of some of the economic and power political dynamics that were underway during World War II, but we will literally talk about how, again, at the institutional level, the U.S. basically recoalesced during World War II as part of an axis, or a part of the axis, or really what happened was that the U.S. joined with Japan and Germany after World War II as a reformed axis. I know that will appear to be insane to many people, but it unfortunately has some unavoidably firm documentary foundations. We will ultimately take a look at how the contemporary Republican Party grew out of and is really an extension of the Third Reich and the SS, and that in turn is inextricably linked with the CIA. The concluding program, or at least part of a program, we'll talk about William Casey, who was Ronald Reagan's campaign manager and head of the CIA. He was in charge of all OSS operations in Germany in 1944 and 45, and is a consummately important historical figure. It was under Casey's watch as Reagan's CIA director that many of the intelligence fronts that we are seeing manifesting in the full court press against China and generally disseminating disinformation to and through the mainstream and unfortunately so-called alternative media as well. In connection, before we get into some of the material, and specifically in tonight's program or in today's program, and also at least for most of the next program, we are going to be relying on a very important essay by the brilliant Berkeley professor Peter Dale Scott. This is from Covert Action number 25 from the winter of 1986, and it's called How Alan Dulles and the SS Preserved Each Other, and that in many ways is a key to what we will be talking about. I thought, though, with all we are hearing about China and Mike Pence talking about how the danger to the world being presented by the Chinese Communist Party, the reality is that China is communist in name only. State capitalism would be a much more appropriate term for what China has become. Neither Karl Marx nor Mao Zedong would recognize contemporary China. We'll talk about this more in the future. Last Sunday's New York Times, last Sunday being August 23rd, the book review section of the Times had a review of the book Evil Geniuses, The Unmaking of America, A Recent History by Kurt Anderson, A-N-D-E-R-S-E-N. The review is by Anand Giridharadas. And there is a short section of this review, and I will read this. It is accurate as far as it goes. In an illustration of this, beginning again, in an illustration of his gift for connection making and framing, he, that is author Kurt Anderson of Evil Geniuses, suggests that what could save the country, meaning the U.S., quote, is a transformative pivot almost as radical for us as the one China made, unquote, when it abandoned communism for capitalism while, Anderson notes for our benefit, more or less preserving the chassis of its political system. That is basically what China did. It is really state capitalism would be a better term for China. It is not a superpower by any means. It is still a developing country, but it has made enormous progress, and it has done so through the partnership of the public and private sectors. And that is something that I think is what one of the things that really horrifies the power political elite in this country about China. It has the same kind of dynamic that in certain respects Franklin D. Roosevelt's New Deal had. It represents a private public partnership for the benefit of both. And beyond that, China, if it goes undestabilized, and I suspect ultimately the destabilization of China will be successful, we'll see, it will become a superpower. And I think one of the foundations of the horror that we are seeing in this country about China is it is deeply and profoundly racist and culturally chauvinistic. China is a former colonialized country, and the Chinese are not white. As we speak, Jacob Blake's shooting in Kenosha, Wisconsin, has galvanized a lot of people. It is, I'm sure, mobilizing a lot of people on behalf of Trump. It has cued demonstrations, some of which are violent, most of which are peaceful. And I think that the racism that some people have spoken about in connection with Black Lives Matter, the death of George Floyd, etc., has eclipsed the fundamentally racist nature of what we are hearing about China. More about that, however, in the weeks to come. Before we get back into the discussion of what was going on during World War II and how Alan Dulles and the OSS and the Nazi SS not only preserved each other, but how the CIA became essentially a landing place, a vessel for the perpetuation and continued operation of the Nazi SS, the Republican Party. In turn, its machinery is an extension of that. And when I hear, on the one hand, the progressive sector saying, "Well, there's no difference between the Republicans and the Democrats," or people waxing nostalgic about the days of bipartisanship, it has taken some time for fascism and Nazism to spread from being a power political elite philosophy within the corridors of Wall Street and the inextricably linked intelligence community in this country, and the broader political milieu. It is now becoming a mass movement. We will be talking about that. I had an interesting thought, and this may be pure baseless speculation, but we were talking about the space plane, and I was ruminating about how far environmental warfare may have gotten. Although the missions of the space plane, which had some of its roots in the liaison between the chairman of Raytheon, Mr. Brown, and SS officer Werner von Braun, the head of America's space program. One of the missions of the space plane has been to convert solar energy into electricity. I have no idea what kinds of technology have stemmed from that, but I would note that the fires that are now burning Northern California were touched off by a massive series of lightning strikes. Whether it is now possible to generate lightning and direct it, I have no idea, but I would note that the U.S., as I mentioned in our last show, and as is discussed in many of the programs dealing with projects, the U.S. and the former Soviet Union had a treaty on environmental modification, including altering the weather for military purposes, on the books by the mid-70s, and in the almost half a century since then. Given the pace of military and scientific advancement, certainly things are exponentially advanced beyond that point. Whether or not that's possible today, that is to say, creating and directing lightning, I don't know. But it is an interesting thought in light of what I spoke about in our last program. I am very suspicious about the drought that has hit Northern California. Certainly there are drought conditions around the world. However, equally certainly, weather modification is a reality. And the first February since they began measuring in California history, there was no rain in Northern California. And I told many people, I said, California is going to burn in the late summer and fall, and it is in a way that it hasn't before. So whether that lightning could actually be A, generated, and B, directed, I don't know, but it is something to contemplate. And since we are not being told what the space plane's missions are, there is a lack of transparency, we are left to wonder about just what is going on. Before we get into discussion of that brilliant article by Peter Dale Scott, I thought I would talk about some things that also deal with events during World War II. They deal with events that touch on Alan Dulles. They deal on events that talk about or that embrace or encompass the fact that fascism is not something that arises from, quote, conspiracy thinking, as some so-called progressives have said, or it doesn't stem from the dynamics of a populist mass movement, although it cues some of those dynamics. It originates with the most powerful corporate/economic elements in our history, and that will figure in what we are about to talk about. Again, against the background of the Republican Convention, and also against the background of a number of articles and editorials that I have seen over the last several years from the what I call the so-called progressive sector, pointing out correctly that Henry Wallace, who was FDR's vice president, was a socialist, and bemoaning his political defenestration and using that to decry, quote, the democratic establishment, unquote. That is not to say that there isn't plenty to criticize in the democratic establishment, but this is being cited by the left. That is to say, the removal of Henry Wallace as FDR's vice president and his replacement with Harry Truman is one of the things that has been cited as ideological finger-wagging exercise by the ideological left. Now, Henry Wallace did have a lot of intelligent things to say. However, he also, in many ways, was the north end of a southbound horse. Henry Wallace was not removed by the, quote, democratic establishment, unquote. Henry Wallace was removed by Alan Dulles, and beyond that, by his own consummate indiscretion, because Henry Wallace was married to the sister of Dr. Charles Brugman, that's capital B-R-U-G-G-M-A-N-N. He was the Swiss ambassador to the U.S. and was serving the economic and power political interests of Switzerland, which were inextricably linked with the powerful corporate slash economic interests that were the foundation of the Third Reich and the foundation of the Third Reich's essential liaison with the U.S., something I've spoken about in many programs, including Miscellaneous Archive Show M11 and recapped in, for the record, 511, among others. A book that we dealt with in the For the Record programs, 914 and 915, called The Grey Wolf, The Escape of Adolf Hitler, co-authored by Simon Dunstan, D-U-N-S-T-A-N, and Gerard Williams, G-E-R-R-A-R-B, Williams, published in a hardcover by the Sterling Press, talks about the escape of Adolf Hitler and attributes that to a deal cut between Alan Dulles and Martin Bormann to assure Hitler's escape from Europe in exchange for the Project Paperclip scientists going to work for the U.S. I suspect there was more to that deal than that. But in that book, there is discussion of Henry Wallace, his marriage to the sister of Dr. Charles Brugman, the Swiss ambassador to the U.S., and a major conduit of economic and political intelligence for the Third Reich, and how it was the consummate indiscretion of the socialist icon Henry Wallace that led not only to his ultimate political removal, but more importantly, in my opinion, to the negation of Operation Safe Haven. That was an attempt at neutralizing the Third Reich's flight capital program that ultimately spawned the remarkable and deadly Bormann organization, literally the economic and political component of a Third Reich gone underground, and the element that I believe will prove to be the decisive factor in human affairs on this planet. I believe the future will be theirs. Had Operation Safe Haven been successfully realized, the Bormann Group would never have come into existence. And there was certainly more to the negation of Operation Safe Haven than could be attributed to Henry Wallace and his indiscretions with his brother-in-law, but that was a major factor indeed. By the way, a couple of things here. Henry Morgenthau was the Secretary of the Treasury, and he had in mind, in a post-World War II Germany, a deindustrialized Germany in which its capacity for waging industrial warfare would be neutralized. This was of great alarm, obviously, not only to Germany and corporate Germany in particular, but to the powerful American Wall Street interests that were aligned with them. And note also, again, that Henry Wallace, FDR's vice president, was married to the sister of Dr. Charles Brugman, the Swiss ambassador to the U.S., and a key source of intelligence for the Third Reich. Simon Dunstan and Gerard Williams write as follows in Grey Wolf, The Escape of Adolf Hitler. Two of the Abwehr agents that Admiral Wilhelm Canaris had activated in Switzerland in 1940 for Habakkuk, that's H-B-A-K-U-K, in the Swiss Foreign Ministry, and, quote, Jacob, unquote, in the Swiss Secret Service. Both organizations received a mass of high-value intelligence via the Swiss ambassador to Washington, Dr. Charles Brugman. This last sentence again, because it's key. Both organizations received a mass of high-value intelligence via the Swiss ambassador to Washington, Dr. Charles Brugman. Yet Brugman was no spy. His source was his brother-in-law, Henry Wallace, who happened to be the vice president of the United States. Wallace was a popular left-wing New Dealer, privy to many of America's most important secrets. He was also notoriously indiscreet. By the autumn of 1944, Admiral Canaris had long been dismissed as chief of the Abwehr and was being held under house arrest under suspicion of involvement in the July bomb plot against Hitler. Nevertheless, as a German patriot, he was horrified at the prospect of his country being reduced deliberately to abject poverty after unconditional surrender, and he quickly passed details of the Morgenthau Plan to Martin Bormann and Joseph Goebbels. The propaganda minister used the information to galvanize the German people to greater resistance, to avoid their country being turned into, quote, a potato field, unquote, in Goebbels' telling phrase. Soon afterward, the details of the plan appeared in the Wall Street Journal. This revelation caused serious divisions within the Roosevelt administration and corporate America, whose investments in Germany were now at further risk. Both General Marshall and General Eisenhower complained bitterly that German resistance stiffened appreciably, with the result that the front lines became stabilized along the Siegfried Line just as winter was closing in. Roosevelt's opponent in the presidential election of November 1944, Thomas E. Dewey, said that the Morgenthau Plan was worth, quote, 10 fresh German divisions to the enemy. Alan Dulles, Dewey's, by the way, I would add, Dewey's chief campaign official in the 1948 presidential election, we'll talk about that in weeks to come, was barely able to contain his indignation at the scheme's propaganda value to the Nazis. Henry Morgenthau's Treasury Department was also the architect of Operation Safe Haven. In order to choke off the flight of capital from the Third Reich, on August 14, 1944, the U.S. and Britain brought severe pressure to bear on Switzerland to sign a trade agreement that would reduce its dealings with Nazi Germany. Now that the tide of war had turned in favor of the Allies, Switzerland was willing to comply, but in reality, the process of money laundering was so pervasive that little was achieved to halt it. Furthermore, almost two-thirds of Switzerland's trade was with Nazi Germany, and in the midst of a world war, it was difficult to judge what was illegal and what was legitimate. Operation Safe Haven was implemented on December 6, 1944, with the aim of tracking the movement of Nazi loot and assets around the world and locating those hidden in neutral countries. However, for Roosevelt and Morgenthau, this plan had a wider purpose. They needed concrete evidence of illegality to bring against the major American corporations that had traded with Nazi Germany and those members of the political establishment who were sympathetic to the Nazis, men such as crypto-Nazi Henry Ford, John D. Rockefeller Jr., son of John D. Rockefeller Sr., the founder of Standard Oil, and advocate of eugenics. Some of these corporations and individuals had tried to undermine the New Deal and destabilize Roosevelt's administration during the 1930s. This ambitious operation sought the prosecution as war criminals of all those who ran the Nazi war machine and the industrial concerns that sustained it. Bankers and industrialists such as Hermann Abs, Hjalmar Horace Greeley Schock, Baron Kurt von Schroeder, Krupp, Fleek, Schmitz, and a legion of others were to stand in the dock of an international tribunal and be judged for their actions. Once they were in open court, Morgenthau would reveal years of intercepted documentation, wiretap evidence, and decrypts of Swiss codes and cables, courtesy of ultra-intelligence via MI6. That, by the way, parenthetically, is British foreign intelligence. In order to redeem themselves, the defendants would have to reveal their dealings with American corporations such as Ford Motor Company, General Motors, and Standard Oil. All the companies and banks found to have traded with the enemy would then face the full rigor of the law in the United States. It was an elegant plan for revenge, legitimized by the victory of good over evil on the battlefield. Since Morgenthau was distrustful of both the Justice Department and the State Department, Safe Haven was entrusted to a select handful of personnel in the Federal Economic Administration, or FEA, of the Treasury Department. The President, through the FEA, instructed a new offshoot of X-2 counterintelligence within the Special Intelligence Division of the OSS to uncover and collect evidence, particularly in neutral countries, concerning the transfers of Nazi loot and gold. However, this effort required the cooperation of OSS agents already on the ground, and in Switzerland, this was problematical, since one of the suspects of Operation Safe Haven was Alan Dulles himself, because of his extensive corporate connections and his links with various Nazi groups. Despite this difficulty, the investigation necessarily focused on the gold dealings undertaken by Swiss banks. This became of major concern to Swiss Ambassador Brugmann once he learned of Operation Safe Haven through his indiscreet brother-in-law, Vice President Henry Wallace. The exposure of the explicit links between Swiss banks and Nazi Germany would be a major potential embarrassment to the Swiss government once the war was over, and accordingly, the Swiss Secret Service alerted Alan Dulles about the Safe Haven investigation into his affairs. So again, it wasn't, quote, the Democratic establishment, unquote, that removed Henry Wallace. It really was his own overly loquacious and indiscreet self. Had he been a little more composed and a little less loquacious, it is possible, but I personally suspect that with all of the powerful corporate links between Wall Street and Nazi Germany, and in turn many of those going through Switzerland, ultimately Safe Haven would have become disclosed anyway. But certainly Henry Wallace was not removed by the Democratic establishment, unquote, or the Democratic Party establishment. It was his own lack of discretion and Alan Dulles and Charles Brugmann and the dynamics that we were exploring in our last program and that we are going to continue to explore in this and our next, at least probably two programs. As I mentioned, we are going to be reading into the record in its entirety. And this article, as well as other very important articles, including some illustrating the economic slash corporate links between Wall Street and the Third Reich. Those are in a very important issue of Covert Action Quarterly. This is from issue number 25 from the winter of 1986. Now, this article is called How Alan Dulles and the SS Preserved Each Other. It is by the brilliant Berkeley researcher, Professor Peter Dale Scott, a name well known to veteran listeners. Now, in this article, it talks about Josef Mengele, the infamous angel of death of Auschwitz. He got to his position as the SS executioner and sadistic experimenter at Auschwitz, courtesy of the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute on Racial Hygiene and Eugenics. That was capitalized by the Rockefeller Foundation, and testimony at Nuremberg indicated that when Mengele was preparing to do one of his infamous experiments on twins, they filled out paperwork which was then dispatched to the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute. Mengele was alleged to have died at the end of World War II. In fact, he not only escaped, but his escape was covered up in part by U.S. intelligence. And it is also speculated, I believe accurately, by Peter Dale Scott, that Mengele's escape and his networking with other SS slash Nazi war criminals like Walter Rauch, Klaus Barbie, and others whom we will hear about, that this was in order to utilize Mengele's expertise as in biological warfare as part of Project Paperclip. In Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, the work of Josef Mengele on behalf of elements of the National Security Establishment of the U.S. in Paraguay is discussed. We'll get into that in our next program. But when I talk about, when I titled this series, The Space Plane and COVID-19, The Paperclip Legacy, part of this deals with people like Josef Mengele, people like Kurt Blom, people like Eric Traub, people like SS officer Werner von Braun, and others who were recruited to go to work for the U.S. National Security Establishment after World War II. Note that Josef Mengele was active in networks that are known to have helped to support people like Klaus Barbie and other elements of the Nazi post-war diaspora in Latin America. I'll come back to that some more later on in the series. Note the role of Alan Dulles in this, and note the role of the Vatican in this. However, as the brilliant and heroic John Loftus, head of the Office of Special Investigations for the Justice Department, noted, it was actually primarily Alan Dulles who made this arrangement, and not the Vatican as much. This is not to say that elements of the Vatican were not involved. They were. But Alan Dulles is the prime mover. And again, the title of this essay, How Alan Dulles and the SS Preserve Each Other, talks about how the SS basically helped to further the career of Alan Dulles, and how in turn Alan Dulles's ideas for a post-World War II Central Intelligence Agency were given life in large measure for their utility in providing a vehicle for the post-war Reinhard Gehlen organization and the SS, which comprised a dominant element of the Gehlen organization. Colonel Charles Colston, Colonel William Corson, that's his name. He was a Marine Corps colonel who was disgusted with the U.S. War in Vietnam. He quit. He resigned his commission in the Marine Corps and became the special advisor to the Church Committee. Colonel Corison wrote a book called The Armies of Ignorance about the U.S. intelligence system, and he described the Galen organization, quote, as, quote, a front for Odessa Nazis, unquote. The Galen organization basically became the CIA's and NATO's eyes and ears on the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, ultimately became the NATO intelligence organization with the same responsibilities, and morphed into the BND while continuing the German intelligence agency, while continuing to supply both NATO and including the CIA with a lot of their, quote, intelligence, unquote, on the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. We're going to begin this essay this week. We will continue with, or in this program, we will continue with this in our next program. Once again, from Covert Action Number 25 from the winter of 1986, how Alan Dulles and the SS preserved each other, by Peter Dale Scott. Dr. Joseph Mengele, the angel of death, unquote, the experimenter and executioner of the German concentration camp at Auschwitz, is perhaps the most notorious of all the unconvicted Nazi war criminals. The exhumation in early 1985 in Brazil of a body which international forensic experts subsequently judged to be that of Mengele has momentarily quieted the demands that he be found and brought to trial. Bear in mind, this article was written about 35 years ago. The supporting evidence and testimony was pervasive enough to silence many initial skeptics. Nevertheless, other wanted Nazi criminals had been erroneously but persuasively reported dead. Adolf Eichmann, for example, had been declared dead in Austria in 1947, quote, on the testimony of one Karl Lukas, L-U-K-A-S, who swore that he had been present when Eichmann died in Prague on April 28, 1945. And when, in the same year, a doctor wrote that she wished to testify against Mengele, the response of Telford Taylor, U.S. Chief of Counsel for War Crimes at Nuremberg, was, quote, to advise that our records show that Dr. Mengele is dead as of October 1946, unquote. At the time of General Taylor's letter, U.S. Army counterintelligence knew both of Mengele's survival and even his location in the small Bavarian village of Autenried, that's capital A-U-T-E-N-R-I-E-D. 4 years after the emergence, four years before the emergence of the latest Mengele death report, a biography of Martin Bormann noticed how the issuance of false death reports, substantiated in some cases by the planting of skeletons, was the standard modus operandi of the post-war Kameradenwerk in South America, to which Mengele and allegedly Bormann belonged. Indeed, the very abundance of such skeletons was enough not only to weaken their credibility, but to confirm that a powerful and ruthless organization was protecting the wanted criminals. In the case of Bormann himself, the Israeli intelligence organization Mossad was to point out that they have been witnesses over the years to the exhumation of six skeletons, two in Berlin and four in South America, purported to be that of Martin Bormann. It is worth recalling that Mengele was reported dead in 1968 after the search for him had been fueled by revelations in the Eichmann trial. Then, as now. The major source for the report was a respected Brazilian policeman, Eric Erbstein, E-R-B-S-T-E-I-N, in 1968, who, quote, specialized in narcotics smugglers, unquote. Erbstein subsequently published a vivid eyewitness account of Mengele's brief capture, release, subsequent recapture, and death by gunfire on a barge at his own hands. When a respected Brazilian policeman with a record of important narcotics arrests describes Mengele's death in vivid detail, it is hard to disbelieve him. But after a second, respected Brazilian policeman with a similar record has supplied a different, wholly incompatible account of Mengele's death, then the credibility of such sources has to be reassessed. Even if the second report proves to be correct, the earlier report remains as evidence that a well-organized conspiracy existed to protect Mengele, like Bormann, with disinformation. The story of Mengele's death is, in this respect, a small synecdoche of the story of Mengele's life. To begin to understand it, one must be prepared to disbelieve authorities that would normally be credible and to explore alternative hypotheses that would normally be dismissed as sheer paranoid fantasy and delusion. The next section, the Mengele Kameraden and U.S. intelligence. By July of 1945, Josef Mengele had been captured and identified at an Allied prisoner of war camp. 40 years later, an eyewitness told a congressional committee how guards knew Mengele's name and also the general nature of his crimes as a doctor, experimenter, and executioner at Auschwitz. Also in 1985, the Simon Wiesenthal Center in Los Angeles released documents obtained from the U.S. Army under the Freedom of Information Act, according to which Mengele, quote, may have been arrested by U.S. authorities in Austria in 1947 and subsequently released, unquote. Yet, like so many of his fellow members of the SS, the bureaucrats of death in the Nazi behemoth, Mengele was somehow allowed to disappear to reemerge 10 years later in Latin America. 20 years ago, only a few would have believed that the victorious Allies in the so-called Good War, unquote, could have deliberately allowed a sadistic mass murderer like Josef Mengele to go free. From the revelations since the Eichmann trial, however, it has become only too obvious that the OSS, the wartime precursor of today's CIA, arranged for numbers of wanted criminals to, quote, escape, unquote, from camps, and when necessary, supplied them with new identities to protect them from justice. Murderers, far from being exempted from such protection, seem to have been among those most likely to obtain it. This is particularly true of those Schutzstaffel, SS elite guard veterans, whose careers have been most closely linked to Mengele's in Latin America. Klaus Barbie, the butcher of Lyon in Bolivia, Walter Rauf, supervisor of the SS mobile gas chambers in Chile, and Friedrich Schwend, yet another wanted murderer in Peru. Schwend, by the way, one of the progenitors of Operation Bernhard, in which British pound notes were expertly forged, and some of those forgeries were actually used, as we looked at in AFA program number 17, to help finance the Vatican Rat Line to usher many of these Nazi war criminals out of Europe and into Latin America, and in many cases into the services of the U.S. national security establishment. Continuing with Peterdale Scott's account, like Mengele, all three of these men developed links with neo-fascist elements in the military or interior ministries of their new countries, or both. All collaborated in repressive operations against the left, particularly at the time of the CIA-assisted overthrow of the Allende government in Chile. Barbie and Schwend, at least, had acted in this capacity through arms deals with the German firm Merex AG, a proprietary firm of the German Bundesnachrichtendienst, or BND, Federal Intelligence Service, itself a descendant of the Galen Intelligence Network, which in 1945 passed from the leadership of the Nazi SS to that of American intelligence and eventually the CIA. We shall see that after World War II, while the CIA and the Galen organization, usually referred to as the Galen Org, were being slowly organized on the U.S. payroll, both Barbie and Schwend worked for U.S. Army Counterintelligence, or CIC, and at this time, Schwend was working on setting up the secret SS escape routes to Latin America, by which both men would eventually reestablish themselves. It has been charged that Ralph played an even more prominent role in setting up the escape route while also on the U.S. payroll, and that he did so with an immunity granted to him by Alan Dulles of the OSS after the OSS secret and sometimes unauthorized negotiations in North Italy, in which unquestionably both Dulles and Ralph participated. The primary purpose of these secret talks was to secure a separate Nazi and fascist surrender in North Italy, and at least partly to prevent a de facto seizure of power by Italian communist partisans behind the Nazi lines. But even the intense fixation which the OSS and the SS shared about reducing the inevitable communist role in post-war Europe does not appear to diplomatic historians to explain the zealous intensity with which Dulles, at times in direct contravention of written orders, pursued negotiations for a surrender which, in fact, preceded that of VE Day by just 6 days. We shall study the same excessive zeal with which future CIA personnel protected the convicted war criminal Barbie and concealed him from the French authorities, who knew very well that U.S. intelligence was hiding him from them. A recent U.S. Justice Department report on the U.S. handling of the Barbie case is clearly an essay in damage limitation, designed to blame low-level people in U.S. Army counterintelligence while suppressing the rather obvious connections to the Galen Org and its then-employers, the CIA. The role of Schwend, and almost certainly Ralph, in exfiltrating whole cadres of wanted SS criminals while on the U.S. payroll only confirms recent speculations that the SS networks were being preserved for post-war anti-communist activities as the result of an arrangement negotiated with Dulles and his OSS superiors. Such an OSS-SS deal does not appear to have been approved at the time at any higher level. Indeed, as late as December of 1945, the U.S. War Department refused U.S. intelligence officers permission to collaborate with even the Galen organization, whose pre-war origins lay not in the Nazi SS, but the eventually decapitated Abwehr, or German military intelligence. More importantly, FDR had already tabled as too controversial the memo from OSS Chief William J. Donovan, which Dulles had drafted, for converting the wartime OSS into a permanent CIA. In dealing with the SS, Dulles and Donovan knew that this risky operation could easily backfire against the OSS, whose organizational future had already been challenged by J. Edgar Hoover and traditionalists in U.S. military intelligence. But they also knew that just as the OSS was the best hope for the survival of the SS cadres, so, in a sense, these cadres were their highest trump card in the impending contest for the OSS's own institutional survival. What ultimately persuaded Truman in 1947 to authorize an operational CIA was, in fact, partly the need to find an institutional home for the post-war Galen Org. In 1948, Dulles, by now a civilian, helped write the memo persuading Truman to take on the Galen Org on Galen's own terms. One of these was that Galen could continue to work with his old OSS liaison, Frank Wisner, chosen by Alan Dulles, rather than Army Intelligence. I'm going to read these last several sentences again, because this really is the thesis of this essay. As we will see, ultimately these same elements become inextricably linked and really are a part of the foundation of the development of the contemporary Republican Party, which, as I speak on August 26th of the year 2020, is holding its convention in Charlotte, North Carolina. One more time. In dealing with the SS, Dulles and Donovan knew that this risky operation could easily backfire against the OSS, whose organizational future had already been challenged by J. Edgar Hoover and traditionalists in U.S. military intelligence. But they also knew that just as the OSS was the best hope for the survival of the SS cadres, so, in a sense, these SS cadres were their highest trump card in the impending contest for the OSS's own institutional survival. What ultimately persuaded Truman in 1947 to authorize an operational CIA was, in fact, partly the need to find an institutional home for the post-war Galen organization. In 1948, by now a civilian, Dulles helped write the memo persuading Truman to take on the Galen organization on Galen's own terms. One of these was that Galen could continue to work with his old OSS liaison, Frank Wisner, chosen by Dulles rather than Army Intelligence. A couple of quick interjections before we continue. Just as Alan Dulles and his brother John Foster Dulles, both of them inextricably linked with the Wall Street Third Reich Axis, were lawyers for the prominent Sullivan and Cromwell law firm that we dealt with, so too Frank Wisner was a very important Wall Street lawyer. He had worked for Carter, Ledyard, and Milburn. That was at one time the general counsel for the Dow Jones Corporation, which used to own the New York Stock Exchange. By the way, it's now privately owned by some relatively obscure individual out of Atlanta. There, at one point, there was also Mr. Harding, another former Carter Ledyard and Milburn alumnus, working as a deputy director of Central Intelligence, and in general, Carter Ledyard Milburn was also a major vehicle for funding, for funneling prominent lawyers from Wall Street to CIA. I will also point out that in 1948 was when Thomas Dewey was challenging Harry Truman for the presidency. Alan Dulles was Tom Dewey's primary campaign official. Tom Dewey's vice presidential candidate was Earl Warren, former governor of California. And it was in the 1948 campaign that the Republican Ethnic Heritage Outreach Organization was formed, which literally constituted a marriage of the Republican Party with the Galen Organization and the Third Reich, and which in turn, as we have seen, was part of the remarkable and deadly Bormann network. Now next, Peter Dale Scott goes on to speculate about how it was that, or why it was that Mengele was able to take advantage of these networks. Peter Dale Scott writes, could Mengele, not even a political policeman like Ralph and Barbie, but a doctor with a penchant for legal experiments on human guinea pigs, could even Mengele have been saved as a result of a secret deal between Dulles and the SS? Such an hypothesis would once have been almost unthinkable, but we have since been told that his colleague in the Auschwitz human experiments, Walter Schreiber, was shielded by the Americans from a Polish conviction in absentia so that he could help guide the post-war researchers of the U.S. Air Force in bacteriological warfare. In 1952, Schreiber was helped by American officials to reestablish himself via Argentina in Paraguay. That is the year that Mengele himself appeared in Argentina, moving to Paraguay 2 years later. In 1981, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists revealed that Mengele's equivalent in Japan, Dr. Shiro Ishii, as well as his assistants, had been granted immunity by the U.S. in exchange for exclusive access to their researchers in chemical and bacteriological warfare. This, despite the fact that Americans had been among the more than 3,000 prisoners of war and civilians killed in the course of their treatment as human guinea pigs. A Soviet war crimes trial in 1949, based on these experiments, was denounced at the time by the U.S. as a simple exercise in propaganda. That Mengele's escape and immunity were arranged by the U.S., like those of Schreiber and so many others, will seem more probable once we have studied the incredible post-war careers of Barbie, Schwend, and Ralph. But before doing so, we must glance forward to the ways in which Mengele's post-war career has overlapped with those of these other SS murderers whom we now know, beginning again about Bosch's last sentence. But before doing so, we must glance forward to the ways in which Mengele's post-war career has overlapped with those of these other SS murderers whom we now know to have benefited from U.S. protection. Last sentence again, because this again is part of the thesis. But before doing so, we must glance forward to the ways in which Mengele's post-war career has overlapped with those of these other SS murderers whom we now know to have benefited from U.S. protection. Despite the books, articles, and TV programs about Mengele, the Angel of Death at Auschwitz, less is known for certain about his post-war activities than those of any comparable war criminal. apart from his extended residence in Paraguay, where he gained citizenship in 1957 and was stripped of it in 1979, little has been documented. But in one of the best books to appear about the post-war network of Rauch, Schwend, and Mengele, the so-called Kameradenwerk, the career of Mengele is closely implicated. And we will talk more about this. We will continue with this article in our next program. However, this concludes For the Record program number 1147, The Space Plane and COVID-19, The Paperclip Legacy, part 2, being recorded on August 26th of the year 2020. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.